Joint Committee on Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy to order, May 22nd. And today we have Dr. Vicki McConnell, who's director of DOGAMI. You all know what that one means. And she's going to be giving the seismic needs assessment of public school buildings and emergency facilities report. And it is a hefty report. I want you all to know that my assistant, Wendy Yorkshire, read this in total. So I've been well briefed.
Well.
So this is a big day. You've worked long and hard on this. And we're very anxious to hear this. So we're getting a few more people. They're going to drag in. So any of you up there listening in your offices, you should come down here so you can get a first row seat. Welcome.
Welcome to you. I just want to have a few comments to make before you start, and that is that sometimes people think the wheels of government grind very slowly, but we know that for several sessions we have been working toward this day. It is extremely important to us because we cannot have too much information as a committee. And certainly the seismic issue and the rehabilitation of buildings, school buildings, particularly are an important part of what we've been trying to do. One of the things that is at the very top of our list is to save lives. And so this information that you will be giving us today, quite frankly, as bad as it is information that we need to know. And the one thing that I would say and did say to Superintendent Castillo this week, and that is that we may not be able to do everything that we can for all the buildings that are going to need to be rehabilitated, but we do need to drill and to know how many minutes it takes us to get our students out of the buildings that you're going to tell us about today. So thank you for your hard work. Thank you for giving us the information that we need that we can now go forward with. And I would ask if also if you would just mention the legislation, both that led to this and also the legislation that is new that is going to be taking us into the future. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Berger and Co-Chair Boone and committee members. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I have with me today, and very honored to have with me today, to my right is the Chair of our Governing Board, Donald Hagenson, who has come down from Portland to make sure that we do our report correctly today. And I'm sure he may have a statement he wants to make as well. And then when he finishes, we'll start into the report, and I will have a couple of introductions then.
Thank you, Vicki. Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Boone, members of the committee. As Vicki said, I'm Don Hagenson, the current chair of the governing board for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. It's a five-member board, as you know, that provides policy direction and oversight and then also adopts rules for the department. This is my fourth four-year term as chair of the governing board for this department. I'm approaching 16 years, and it's been a labor of love for me. It's something that I've really enjoyed doing. You can't beat the pay either, since I don't get paid. One of the significant things about the board, and it's been true the whole time I've been on the board, is that they provide very important geologic information, and they have real passion about providing geologic information to the state of Oregon and the citizens of Oregon. In particular, focused on natural hazards, you know, of which we have more than enough, you know, between potential for volcanic eruptions, landslides, floods, potential for earthquakes, potential for tsunamis. And this effort, there have been many significant efforts along the way, but this effort, to my way of thinking and the rest of the board's thinking, is one of the most significant things that the department's ever done. And it's really critical information to have out there, and I guess it's up to you folks and us folks to see what happens next. So that's all of my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but if not, I'll turn it over to Don.
Any questions? Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
What we are going to do today, well, actually, before that, if you would just indulge me for just a moment, I did want to recognize a couple of folks. We also have in the audience today Mr. Jim Doan, who is the chair of OSPAC, which is the Oregon's Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. And they have also had a key role or a crucial role in working toward all these years of working toward seismic, both the awareness and seismic safety in this state. And finally, as my recognitions, I just want to go on record and recognize the seismic needs assessment team that we put together to get this report out. I mean, it's just both our internal staff and the consultants that we brought in and the university, the professors and everyone and the students we worked with, they have done a phenomenal job. And I just really want you, you know, I know from reading the report and looking at it that you understand there is so much information there. It was just tremendous. I just couldn't be prouder of them. And I hope that the rest of the state will feel that way, too. So what we're going to do today is we're going to take you through the assessment, how we started this, why we got started on it, and explain then discuss what our findings were. We're also going to discuss our recommendations for the next steps. And as Co-Chair Verger mentioned, we will really begin that by taking you through the steps of where we are in our decade-long work that the state has endeavored to get us to seismic safety. And we'll walk through that a little bit. We'll talk about Senate Bills 2, 3, 4, and 5 from 2005 that were key to where we are now. And then we'll finish up by talking about the new legislation that will take us to the next step. And with that, I'll turn it over to Don Lewis for a little bit to go through the nuts and bolts.
Thank you, Vicki. Co-Chair Verger, Co-Chair Boone, and the rest of the committee. My name is Don Lewis. I'm the Assistant Director and Manager of the Geological Survey portion of the Department of Geology. If we could have the screenshot. There we go. Hopefully I won't go through this too rapidly. It's a series of slides, of images, which you've got copies of to make notes on if you choose to, where we've selected the sort of foundation of the work we've done, the information we pulled together, the technique that we use to analyze the results and present the results, and also what it means and how to interpret it, and perhaps some comments on its flaws as well. So you have the context of this piece of work. It's general in nature, but it's comprehensive in scope. In terms of what's been mentioned already, this, of course, this work's been ongoing since long before our time, from the mid-80s and beyond. Some of the next slide will actually direct some of the attention to specific bills in the last legislative session. But this has been going on since at least the start of the century in terms of real intimate effort. Including, of course, in the November election of 2002, the voters approved the constitutional amendments that allowed the creation of the article, what are known as Article XIM and N bonds, which are intended to fund the state's portion of the seismic rehabilitation for education and emergency facilities. So today, here we are to talk about our results. Now, this is a very busy slide, and I won't bore you with the intimate details, but a couple salient facts for you to sort of carry with you as for all these slides as we go forward. The image on the left side is a picture, as you can see, of the Pacific Northwest, and in Oregon in particular, and this is a portion of the federal government's effort to build what they call a ground motion model. And all that really means is that their team of scientists at the USGS have built into this model factors related to every credible and conceivable earthquake that would shake the ground. And so it includes the Cascadia-style earthquake off the Oregon coast. It would include shallow earthquakes in the Klamath Falls area and elsewhere in Oregon. So the shape that you see there and the color ramp from darker to brighter red-type colors, that's showing increased intensity of ground motion that's predicted for a maximum earthquake in that location. So again, these results we're going to show are based on a maximum event. Just for your reference, the slide on the right is FEMA then takes this kind of information, and they have computer models as well, of course, and they run, this particular one is related to an annual earthquake loss model. And all it's really showing is for every county in the country, the relative annual expected losses due to earthquakes. And there's some notes there as to some of the factors they build in. But again, it's directly tied to this ground motion and the building stock and the nature of the buildings and actually the people inside them. You can see that they actually, in some way, in some manner, include casualties in their estimates. You can see that Oregon has some brighter colored counties, which reflect higher risk and losses. And these are losses over a long period of time averaged. This is a very busy slide that describes the legislation from the last session in 2005, Senate Bills 2, 3, 4, and 5. And we're here today to really focus on Senate Bill 2, which are the directives that our agency got to do this assessment. And it included specific details on the kinds of buildings we were supposed to look at and their nature. And I'll make some comments on that. And then it flows in along the as the slide indicates on next to a grant committee that's to establish, you know, who qualifies to be an applicant, how they qualify, how they make an application, and all that detail. So that's sort of a next step. And then beyond that are the mechanisms for funding the state's portions. And again, portion has not been identified, so there's a lot of work yet to be done. Those numbers that you see in the two corners are theoretical numbers, and they're driven purely by the arithmetic you see there. The 1/5 of 1% of the true market value of state assets. That's determined by the Department of Revenue every year in their property tax report. And so that's the current number that equates to that equation. So, in summary form, the instructions that our agency received to do these surveys, this screening, this assessment of all these buildings, and again, it's education and emergency services, is to conduct this effort using what's called a FEMA 154 approach. And you'll hear too much about what that means, but I'll define what FEMA 154 means. And then we are told to rank these as we are able to, on these bases, on need, importance of the building, risk posed by its location, risk to the community by its collapse, costs, and other categories. Well, we aren't capable and qualified to address each one of those risk categories, and so we focused, of course, on the overall seismic risk and building collapse issue. We do attempt to address need in the form of fiscal need, and we've also looked at location in the form of tsunami inundation. We were not able to address things like landslides that may result due to severe earthquakes, but that would be perhaps a next step. And then, of course, we're told to develop all this in a geographic information system, a computer system, so that all interested parties can have access to the data. So we've achieved that. So, two sets of buildings, and this slide is discussing the public education buildings, but basically you change a few words and you got the same scenario for emergency buildings. So we'll just look at this one slide. Basically it's a flow chart, if you like, of defining the universe of buildings, what qualifies for inclusion, the work that we're told to do this FEMA 154 and all the detail that goes into that, and then rank them. And so the key first step in terms of education buildings is that we are told that the key criteria for a qualifying school, public school, is a 250-person capacity and in regular use. by students. So, for example, an administrative building that is not used regularly by students does not qualify. A modular building that cannot possibly have 250 people in it does not qualify. And we, of course, do not have, and there does not exist in the state, a data set that says this is the capacity of every school and school building in the state. So we used enrollment as a proxy for capacity. We started with 200 as the number, and we eventually worked our way, you know, going back and forth with how much can we afford, how much time do we have to do this work, and we got down to 154. So basically, we covered every school in the state that has 154 students or greater, as well as at least 90% of all students in every county. We actually achieved 97% of enrollment. And if a school or critical facility was located in or potentially near an inundation zone for tsunamis, we just threw it in no matter what its size. So we included a school, for example, that had 8 students in it. So the rest of this discussion really is describing the rest of that slide. This is the universe of sites. There's a little over 2,000 sites that we located and found. And the schools were not a terrible challenge as to where they are and what they are. The emergency facilities was a huge challenge. There was not a database that said, this is the list of fire stations and here's their address, here's the police stations and here's their address. So we did a lot of back and forth, a lot of phone calls, a lot of meetings, a lot of, you know, cold calls as to, well, here's your post office box, where is your building? And we hear that there's a fire station here, where is it? So there's a lot of that, and hopefully we believe that we've captured most of those buildings. We know that we've probably missed a few. So we apologize for any accidental omissions. 2,000 sites, a little over 3,300 buildings. And the difference between a site and a building is that, as you'd expect, a building could be isolated buildings on a school campus, or they could be attached buildings that are attached but are of different nature, like a gymnasium and the rest of the school. So those are two different buildings. This technique, FEMA 154. It's a federal technique developed over the last 20 years and used widely across the country by FEMA, and they have a whole team of structural engineering consultants. It's known as the Applied Technology Council, that has this handbook that was most recently updated in 2002 that describes this process that we're going to share with you. This slide depicts the purpose and what you result from this approach. Basically, it creates an inventory, as we've been hinting at. You know, you have to know where everything is and what its, you know, what its nature is. So that's what we're doing. We're identifying where the older versus younger buildings, which are the ones built on rock versus on soil and soft soil, and which of the ones have characteristics. And you can see the sort of engineering speak there, having performance characteristics that negatively influence their seismic response. It means they have a shape that doesn't do well when the building shakes. Because of the forces that ripple through the whole building, it gets to a corner, for example, and kind of ruptures or explodes at that point because there's discontinuities. So anyway, what it is not, this is a general survey. We are not doing, this is not a detailed engineering study. And we did not hire structural engineering consultants. We hired professors and their students who were trained in this and experienced in this technique. There's a few medical analogies, if you like, there. They're not a perfect fit, but they sort of give the impression of what we're talking about. You know, we're not doing any invasive tests. We don't have any specific building plan detail for every building. And so these are observational characteristics that we're capturing and then turning into a score. These are the 5 key factors that determine the end result. And, you know, it makes sense once you sort of take a look at it. And I'm going to show you some examples of each one of these 5 things. The seismicity zone. And all that really means, again, is how much is the ground going to shake, where you are. The building type. There's 15 possibilities. Building irregularities. You know, is it an L shape or an E shape? Has it got vertical irregularities? Is it old or young or brand new? And is it built on rock or on soil? That earlier slide I showed you assumed that all buildings are built on rock. It's called a B soil. Don't ask me why they call rock soil, but engineers do that. So, a B is a rock. C, D, and E, which are different forms of soil in this methodology, are worse than rock because rock sound waves and energy travels through it very rapidly, and it doesn't create much amplitude. When it hits soil, especially soft soil like soft sand that's saturated with water and stuff, the waves slow down, and that increases the amplitude, and as you know from photographs from San Francisco and other places, that's where the real problems start to occur. So, this is the end result of the seismicity zones for Oregon. There actually are only two official seismicity zones, and those are on the right. The right slide is right portion of the slide is dominated by that, I don't know what that is, sort of a peach color, and that's called a moderate seismicity. And then towards the western part of the Willamette Valley and towards the coast, that's all considered high. In other words, it's going to shake more. And then we've introduced, it doesn't affect the scoring, but we've introduced a sort of special category which is very high. And the reason for that is that these ground models, these ground motion models, demonstrate that that area will shake twice as hard and twice as much as the regular high. So even though the scores don't reflect it, we've identified those locations as you've got an extra problem. So, for example, every location on the coast is effectively going to have an underreported score. It's not going to be as bad as it might be because the technique doesn't allow for it. Here's some of the building types. You know, engineers just love this stuff. There's basically, you know, four different kind of construction materials and three or four different construction techniques. And as you sort of look at the images, you can see, well, really, you know, there's wood frame buildings like a house, big school. There's what's known as concrete shear wall, a lot of urban buildings that you see. They've got big walls of concrete that's poured in place with lots of reinforcement in it. That's concrete shear wall. And then sort of a concrete block, the RM1 down in the lower left corner. That's actually the most dominant building type in Oregon for all these facilities. And they've got some special problems. But that is the facts. You know, that's one of the things we find out, is that these reinforced masonry buildings are the dominant type of building. And, of course, the key thing for them is how much steel is actually in the building. There were exceptions up until 1990 in the building code where you didn't really have to put all the R in through the reinforced masonry. So it's questionable as to how much is there and what type, what the connections are. There's lots of detail that we can't ascertain from walking around on the sidewalk. Here's some of the examples of irregularities. And again, these things affect the scoring process, and I'll walk you through an example. These are all bad things. So what's called a setback, which is a change in plan in a vertical view. You can see that a lot of buildings you're familiar with from downtown Portland look just like that. That's not a good thing when it shakes. Built on a hillside, or having what's called a soft story. That's basically where you typically park your cars in a garage. There's concrete columns holding up the rest of the building. Doesn't really perform well. Tends to collapse and pancake. In terms of the plan irregularities, the vertical irregularities are a very negative score. It's actually one of the single most important thing in this whole process. The plan irregularities, as you can see, is just the different shapes and nature of the buildings. Age of buildings. Here's the distribution by the three major types, if you like, of schools, police and fire, and community college buildings. And these are stacked one behind the other. They're not on top of each other. So schools really are that many more schools, and we know they're that much bigger. And as this slide indicates, they're that much older. Oregon's first statewide building code was only really introduced in 1973, although the larger cities had codes from the late 20s. And those were tied to some of the structural codes for the West Coast, primarily driven by California. But Oregon as a whole really didn't start to catch up until the 70s. And then, as we know, we didn't know about this big threat off the coast of the Cascadia subduction zone. So the seismic zone rating for Oregon was very low. So that even by the early 90s, there was virtually no concern for earthquakes in Oregon. And that's really just changed in the last 15 years.
Can I ask you a quick question right here? Are most of the schools one story, or how does that play out?
Yes.
And does that matter?
They're mostly one story. We include that in the database, okay. The number of stories, whether it has a basement or not. Falling hazards. There's a lot of information in our data set that actually doesn't affect score, but we've included four additional information.
Okay.
So you're just seeing the tip. So this slide is sort of a precursor of the results. Soils. Remember, rock is what the assumption is. The green shade on that map you see there is the rock. All those brighter colors are different kinds of soils. And they're where you think they are. They're along rivers. They're along the coast. They're out in the Great Basin, in those old lakes, those Playa lakes. And so you build on those, you've got special considerations. So, here's one example of how this scoring system works, and also a description of the protocols that we adopted as part of this scoring technique. So the assumption here is that you all are now trained at conducting FEMA 154 screenings. You're out on the out-of-school campus, and you're faced with, what kind of building am I looking at? So we've asked you to make a primary, a secondary, and a tertiary, or third choice. You don't have to do that, and in fact, most of the time, our screeners, who are actually trained at this quite rigorously and are experienced at it, only made one choice. But they could make up to three if they weren't sure. And the reason they're not sure is that most schools, for example, have brick cladding on them, or some other form of cladding that disguises their structural nature. And so this technique allows for having more than one choice. And the protocol that's followed is that even if you're 90% sure of your primary choice, if you've made a secondary choice or a third choice, and it's a lower score, we're going with that. So we've always gone with the lowest score for the worst type of building. This happens to be in a seismicity zone high. FEMA's directive or protocol is to use 1941 as a pre-code date. This building we're looking at was built in 1986, so we know that because there's a plaque on the building. A lot of buildings have plaques on them. And then, for these various structural types, the code means different things at different times, the building code. So, for example, for wood buildings, the key date is 1979. Buildings built in Oregon from 1979 or younger get a what's called a positive post-benchmark modifier, which means the score goes up just because it's newer, and it's wood. However, different building types have different dates. So all this information is all meshing together and ending up with a score. This particular building has irregularities, so the scores are applied, and it happens to have the worst soil and e-soil, so the scores are applied. You know, a careful eye will see that some of the scores are actually different from each other, and that's because these structural engineers have studied this and have applied all kinds of investigations as to how buildings perform, have developed different numbers for different types of buildings. But at the end of the day, they're all supposed to be equal in terms of the final score. So in this particular case, the ending score for this concrete shear wall type is 0.5. And I'm going to explain what a 0.5 and other scores means. The lower the score, the worse. It's got a greater probability of collapse. At the bottom of that slide are the distribution of the numbers of kinds of buildings. And there you can see just from a glance that, the reinforced masonry dominates, followed by wood and the concrete shear wall type building. Fire stations have this interesting and positive characteristic where a lot of their buildings are built out of light structural steel, light steel frame buildings. That's called this S3 type. You can see there's quite a bulge there. That's a good thing because they perform very well. So here's the results for K-12 schools, 2,200 buildings or so. And kind of confusing, you can see the nature of the slide. There's this big bulge towards the bottom, and it's actually, that's centered on a score of about 1. Now, what does a 1 mean? What does a 2 mean? What does a 0 mean? The way these scores work is there's some arithmetic involved. It's, and I'll actually share the formula with you so that you've got something to share at your next gathering, family gathering. The formula is basically 1 over 10 to the score, to the power of the score. So, for example, 1 over 10 squared, a score of 2, is 1 in 100. So a probability of 1%. So you can see there on the slide, the 1% probability collapse is a score of 2. Score of 1 is 10 times worse because it's 1 over 10, 10 to the 1, 10%. Score of 0 is 10 to the 0, which is 1. So 1 in 1, 100% probability of collapse. As you can see, you can actually have negative scores, but we won't worry about that because it's effectively zero. It's 100%. So in this slide, you can see that there's a lot of buildings of these various building structural types that have high probabilities of collapse for schools. Quickly toggling over to fire and police stations. In fact, I'll go back and forth a couple times to get you dizzy. You can see that the bulge sort of shifts to the right. It shifts to the right, and it's because the scores for these kinds of buildings are higher. They're not as risky. They aren't as, haven't got as high a probability of collapse. And the reason for that is fairly straightforward if you think about it. They're smaller buildings. They tend to be like box shapes. They're not complicated with wings all over the place, with gymnasiums attached to them. So it makes sense. Busy slide. It's really designed for sort of scientist types. But again, this is now adding up all the scores on from a 0 to 100% on the left-hand axis. The green line are the schools. The pink line are the fire and police. And the value of this slide is to show you that at a selective probability of collapse, so in other words, 10%, this technique indicates that a little over half of the school buildings have a 10% probability of collapse during the big earthquake, whereas a quarter of the fire and police stations do. Those numbers go down at the 100% level. Those numbers go down to about 16% for schools and around 7% for fire and police. Here's the final results for all schools for all scores of all types. We've broken it down further into different types of fire and police stations because, again, we're trying to get down to the district and ownership level of these different types of buildings because they're the applicants who are going to apply. There's cities, there's rural fire protection districts, there's sheriff's offices, there's the Oregon State Police. And then there's schools. And as you can see from the slide, schools are generally worse. And all those colors you see there, the very high, high, and moderate, we recommend that every one of those gets a look at with a detailed engineering report. We're recommending that there's a focus on the very high and high, but let's not forget about the moderate as well. This is just the same data stacked on top of each other, so you can see kind of overwhelming the numbers of schools. We counted those 274 buildings translates to one or more buildings at 193 schools. So there's 193 schools that are going to have some or all of their facilities with this very high risk assessment.
Madam Chair, can I ask a quick question?
Go ahead, Senator.
At what level, and maybe I just missed it earlier in your presentation, at what level are we talking about on the Richter scale does this kind of failure happen? And maybe I just missed that earlier.
Well,
because when we had the Mount Angel, that was a pretty hard rocking earthquake in Mount Angel with an unreinforced masonry building, and they didn't go in total collapse. So I'm trying to figure out where are we talking about where we're actually talking about 10, 30, or 50% collapse.
Thank you, Senator George. That's an excellent question, and a question almost everyone asks. You're the first. In the Mount Angel area, it would be basically the equivalent of the worst earthquake that is likely to occur on that fault in that location. So, for example, that would be around magnitude 7 earthquake on the Mount Angel fault system. For other locations, for example, closer to the coast, it really is completely dominated by the Cascadia event, you know, the magnitude 9 earthquake. And that event dominates most of the west of Oregon. The rest of Oregon is really dominated by these smaller, more local, shallower earthquakes, and they would be of lower magnitude. So it's sort of difficult to translate magnitude to.
If I could, Madam Chair, so what you're saying is a sliding scale based on the risk in that area having the biggest earthquake possible in that area. So it's sort of a...
A sliding scale, and it's cumulative. It adds them together.
Okay, thank you.
Co-Chairs and Senator George, and it's in that case, it's based on the hazard, not the risk. It's how the earthquake or fault system in that area has been identified.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
The geographic distribution of these results is shown on this slide by collapse potential category. And you can see from the brightest color, the orange-red color, that the very high class potential is scattered throughout the state. Sure, there's clusters, and the distribution pattern in general, of course, follows the transportation corridors and the cities where people live. But it's not difficult to find problems in almost every county.
Madam Chair, may
yes,
I?
Senator Morrison.
Adding to that last question, would a 9.2 on the Cascadia Fall translate into a 6-point-something in the valley in Portland down to the school that you mentioned?
Senator Morissette, if I understand the question is a magnitude 9 on the coast, does that same event translate to a 6 in the valley?
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Because basically this model that the federal government came up with is that the amount of shaking, that ground motion model, the ground motion is worse on the coast, but it's the same event in the valley. And so and I didn't go into the numbers, but the way the numbers work is that they measure it in terms of percentage of gravity, which is the acceleration due to this ground motion. And so, for example, on the coast, and there's detail, but on the coast, the force due to this motion would be a half of gravity or a full gravity. So in other words, it'd be like the whole building jumping up and down or from side to side. Whereas in the valley, it'd be about half of that. And as you get further away from the source zone, it goes down. But it's the same. It's not really a different magnitude.
Well,
it's different intensity.
Okay. Do we know what damage will be done as a result of a 9.2 on the coast? Do we know how many bridges in Portland are liable to come down? Do we know the amount of damage, even though it's a much lesser amount? Because when that happens on the coast, it's going to affect a lot of other people. So I guess my real question is, what's the collateral damage?
Co-chairs and Senator Morissette, again, that's really, you know, beyond the scope of what we were doing here, but it's certainly looking at infrastructure like the bridges and the infrastructure corridors, looking at other types of public buildings, etc. There have been some studies done more localized, but it is recognized, for example, by the city of Portland and by the metro area that what they assess to whenever they're looking at issues are usually what would happen to them if they had a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake.
Well, and I guess that translates into what happens to the schools. I mean, there is a connection.
Oh, absolutely.
So we have that big one on the coast.
Right.
It's going to definitely. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The next slide is only looking at the brightest dots, the very high category, and then sort of breaking it out by the different types of buildings we look at. The green squares are the K-12 public schools. And again, there's more of them than there is anything else. The stars are various form of fire and police. And on this slide and in table form ad nauseum, we've got detail of every site and building we looked at. So this is just a depiction of, again, it's not just schools. There's various buildings of various kinds, again, scattered throughout the state that have this issue. Now, this is possibly a controversial slide. The next question people ask is, well, what's the impact? What's the relative scale of this? We don't know a real good answer to that. So this is a rough estimate, or a guesstimate, if you like, an educated guess, of the rehabilitation cost of just the very high-risk buildings. So in other words, just those buildings on the previous slide, just these ones. And if you apply the same cost per square foot to each one, it's a very crude technique, and the number we picked is $15 a square foot. For some kinds of buildings, that's a low number. For other kinds of buildings, it's a high number. It's a fair and reasonable estimate for this nature or level of look. However, the detail really matters, and every party and district that wants to look at this needs a more detailed evaluation by professional engineers to get a better estimate, because that's really the only way you're going to do it.
I guess I'll just add one thing in this. And it's very obvious, the costs are going to be swamped by the K-12 schools in this.
in terms of looking at what's the other axis to put against risk. We've been all this time we've been talking about seismic risk, and thank you for listening to us on that. The other thing we were asked to look at is need. And need means different things to different people, but we interpreted that there was a incentive to determine fiscal need. We don't have the exact tools to do that, but we accessed readily available federal and state data and applied it to schools in particular, since schools are the biggest issue on this whole plate, and have shared that data in the table format so that it can be considered in terms of assessing who's got more need than someone else. And of course it's not really fair to say people in different locations that have the same risk have different need. However, we were asked to do this, so this is the approach we took. And here's just two examples, or I suppose three examples, of how we looked at schools. We just looked at U.S. Census data, the small area income and poverty estimate data that they put out every few years. That predicts that actually estimates the amount of poverty, amount of children in poverty enrolled in each school district in the country. We grabbed the data for Oregon. The average for Oregon is 14%. There's a wide range, from just a few percent to nearly 30%. It's different by school district. We also looked at the amount of property tax that each school district is imposing. And then we compared that to the amount of students enrolled in their school districts. The average for Oregon is $2,600, and there's a wide range. Those two factors are strongly correlated, as you can see from this slide. Districts that generally have low poverty also have high property values. And the reverse is also true. So this is the 43 largest districts, and it has actually a strong correlation. We've provided this information for the grant committee for their consideration. A third method is to actually look at the bonding that the districts have done over the last decade. There's been a tremendous success. 92 districts have issued bonds for new schools, for acquiring land, for doing rehabilitation work. Many school districts have already gone far down this path, and we've captured some of their results. Finally, one of the things we looked at is, along the coast, the additional risk of tsunami inundation. This slide happens to be just for illustration. It's of the Cannon Beach area, and it's really just to depict that although we're here, we're looking at computer models, there's different forms of earthquake and there's different tsunamis. So this computer model slide is really just showing there's different inundation over time. And in some locations, in Cannon Beach and elsewhere on the coast, for every one of these Cascadia events, you're going to be inundated. If you're further inland or at particularly a higher elevation, not always. We know there's been 16 or 17 of these events. They're not always the same size. So this kind of example is there's different amounts of risk, and it's really tied to your elevation along the coast. Here's a slide that summarizes it. There's a table online with all the rest of our results that actually lists the detail of all these sites. We looked at 150 sites. You can see that 48 of them have high risk of inundation, which means there is certainty that they will be inundated. And there's a larger number of sites that have less certainty. They may or may not, but it's possible. So all these sites, we've also included that information. Online, we've got a variety of tools to help people wade their way through this very dense information. Here, for example, is a slide, a screen you'll come to when you log on to our website. And you can search for data by city, by the name of the facility, by county, by whether it's a school or not. And they'll come up with results. Here's two parts of the results. You'll get a table for whatever you've asked for. The table will be the list of buildings in the category of information you've asked for. Let's say for Polk County. Yes, for all the data from Polk County, it'll come up with scores and results and what we think about it. Then, on the left-hand side, you can see that the names of these schools, as they are underlined. That means you can click on each one of those, and you'll get a report And the report on the right happens to be for Happy Valley Elementary School. But you'll get a report that tells you and shows you where these buildings are on the property and how the score was developed and other factors on other pages, including photographs, that demonstrate what the problems are. So this is part of our GIS information we're providing for interested parties. Also, you can search by map. This happens to be an aerial photo of where we're at right now. The Capitol building, you can see down in the sort of lower left quadrant. The way this works is that you can scroll around. This happens to be, you can download this into Google if you're a Google user. There's other software programs that, aficionado, I suppose. There's other programs you can download into and use those as well. So you get a spatial reference. And again, you can scroll around. And as your cursor hits one of these balloons, it'll light up with results. So sort of a spatial reference. That really summarizes our presentation, and we have recommendations.
Thank you, Don, very much. Where we recommend at this point, where we go from now, and let me summarize what we've seen here is, we were asked to conduct these assessments to get a scope of whether there was an issue on seismic vulnerability of public schools, community colleges, and emergency response facilities. Based on what we have ascertained in this, in our compiling of all those data, we would certainly recommend that we go forward with initiating what's called the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Committee, which is the mandate of Senate Bill 3 of last session, which would ask the Office of Emergency Management to administer this grant committee. And the grant committee would then develop a granting program. The granting program, what that means, they'll develop the criteria for who could apply and what kind of information they need to get together to apply for any type of program, that granting program that is established. They have a big job in front of them. Now that we know that we have enough of an issue here to really to legitimize the fact that we need this grant committee, we look at this as again, this is the next step in going toward developing a state that is going to have a statewide seismic health. In other words, we're going to be try for as high a seismic safety as we can. We would suggest that once that committee is up and running, that they would report back to the Emergency Preparedness Committee and the 2008 session to give you an update on the information and how they have begun to set their criteria and begun to set the program. That would be a way of continuing the information and continuing to keep the state updated. They're certainly going to have to, districts that we have identified here, school districts, fire districts, police districts, etc., if they are interested in finding out specifics about what the hazards that their buildings face, we recommend that they contract or hire consultants, seismic rehabilitation consultants, to test and confirm our findings. But because, again, we stress these are assessments. They are not detailed structural evaluations. At some point, there'll have to be a compare and contrast. There'll have to be a dialogue about comparing and contrast rehabilitation or retrofit versus the benefit of reconstruction of buildings. And again, that's out of our purview. That's a community or a district discussion or a dialogue. And, we would certainly suggest that they have that discussion. Those are our primary recommendations. We do know that Senator Courtney today did introduce his Senate Bill 1, which would appropriate a certain amount of funds to the Office of Emergency Management to assist with staffing so that they can begin to get this Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Committee together. And I would say that in Senate Bill 3, there are several organizations that are identified that should sit on this committee, and then there would be other entities and organizations that I'm sure will be willing to participate in it as well. Thank you. That concludes our part of the presentation. If we have any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Very much. That's very informative. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, forgive me if this question has been asked, and I'll withdraw it if it has. But I just opened to this page, Multnomah County. If I'm a member of a school board in Multnomah County and I see this display, what should be my reaction in terms of this document becoming a public document and the fact that the...
Senator, co-chairs, and Senator Johnson, we did not explain that detail. The detail of that, that's Appendix A, as you've opened to, that is actually explained on page 15, and those colors are related to whether or not a school qualifies for inclusion in this assessment. So, for example, a white-colored school is included.
Is included.
A green school, we've chosen to include, and that's down to a certain size and county representation. Those 500 pink-colored schools that represent 2.3% or so, 3%, let's say, of the student body of Oregon, in 500 schools are typically very small schools scattered throughout the state, and they were not as part of our instructions to assess every school in the state. Oh. So the answer to your question would be then that Multnomah County should consider looking at those schools independently, if they choose to, for their seismic vulnerability.
Oh, follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So I'm the mother of a child in one of the pink schools, and I think, well, why wasn't my school included? Is this an indication that my child is safe? Is it an indication that you didn't care about my child? Is it an indication that people are going to, as we all do, I mean, I opened up this book, and the first thing I did was turn to counties in my district. I think we all tend to do that. And I was trying to glean what instruction I could out of the book. I don't know how that data comes to the public and how it's managed and or manipulated as it comes to the public with respect to okay, the state has identified some schools that clearly need assistance. And what was the decision? I've got one of my schools that you guys added that was built in 1903, and one that was excluded that was built in 1917. I've been in that school. It's a brick structure. It just begs the question, what was the criteria?
The criteria was enrollment. So, for example, the three criteria were enrollment, whether or not 90% of enrollment in any one county was achieved or not, and again, we achieved 97%, and whether or not the school is in or near a potential tsunami inundation zone, in which case we included every school.
And co-chairs and Senator Johnson, because I don't think you were here at the very beginning.
Don't then take the committee's time to go over the remedial.
Well, just very quickly, Senate Bill 2 of 2005 had some specific criteria on what schools we were supposed to look at. K through 12 schools with a capacity of 250 or more. So we stretched that as far as we could to include as many schools as we could in this assessment. But we were still limited by that at the beginning of the assessment.
Okay. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Let's go to page 12. And it says the Oregon Seismic Risk Assessment. It talks about the $180 million. Can it be done for $15 per square foot? I mean, I'm sure you guys struck an average. What do I think it would take to...
In the report, there's some examples, some case studies, and I can't remember the exact page numbers. If I looked at before, I could. It's in Section 6, I believe, where there's examples from Portland and Hillsboro and some of the fire station districts, Salem and Portland as well. There's different issues between different standards at different facilities. So, for example, one of the issues that everyone's going to face is that the Article XIM and N bonds relate to life safety standard. So life safety, in terms of engineering speak, that actually has a definition as to what that means. It's in the middle of the road in terms of standards. The highest standard would be sort of continued operations. And that's where typically emergency facilities like to be. But unfortunately, the legislation actually doesn't consider that. So this is for life safety standards for both types of buildings. The $15 a square foot is a rough estimate. In the text, you'll discover a FEMA online estimator tool that they have, where they'll, if you plug in number data, they'll tell you what the database says is the estimates for Oregon. Those numbers typically end up being lower than $15 a square foot. However, that's based on 1996 data, and as we all know, construction costs have gone up considerably since 1996. We have over 110 structural engineering report cost estimates for different school districts in Oregon. Portland, for example, spent over $20 million in the late 90s and early this decade doing seismic rehabilitation in their buildings. It averaged approximately $3 a square foot. Hillsboro, which is highlighted in the report, has two different categories of buildings. Wood frame buildings average about $6. Concrete buildings average $20. So again, the devil's in the details, and all it is a crude estimate.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for all the hard work and the team, the 13, 14 people, it looks like, that did this. This is as depressing as it is, but it's extremely helpful. And I totally agree with Senator Johnson. If you were a parent and had a kid in one of these schools, you'd want to know. And the other thing I wanted to ask you on the recommendations, if a school district is determining whether or not to do rehab or reconstruction completely, then it would be incumbent on them to go out and get an engineering study and get that assessed at that point, based on your recommendations.
Chair Boone and Chair Verger and committee members, that's correct. And really, as our recommendations say, we encourage all of the entities that are responsible for these buildings, be it a fire district or school district or whatever, once they look at these data, to consider having a structural report, an analysis done of those buildings that are identified, and really nail down, what needs to be done and what the issues are. We simply, couldn't get to that kind of detail with this report. And one other thing I do want to say is, this is our absolute best effort at being as precise with this information as possible. We do expect there are errors and omissions in here. I'm sure there's going to be a school that will be identified that says, wait a minute, 3 years ago we did this. And that's fantastic. They should just make sure they let us know, and we will continue to update the database. That'll be important information as well.
Are you planning to how do you disseminate the information that the report's available? Will there be some sort of email blast or whatever
to everyone in the state?
Everyone in the state.
Well, we expect the email blast will probably come in the newspaper reports tomorrow, and that is why, as of 3:01 today, we went online with all this information on our website, www.oregongeology.com, and you can simply go in there. You can download the report. You can, as Don was explaining, you can search through the data in a whole variety of ways. If you want to look at it map-wise, or if you want to look at it with the list and the tables, it should be pretty straightforward. And we have a list of frequently asked questions, and we'll be available to help folks with this as best we can.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. If I'm an insurance executive and I'm looking at this, what am I drawing out of it in terms of knowledge and liability?
You want to take a stab at that one?
Certainly, co-chairs and Senator Johnson. The insurance industry is far ahead of us in terms of understanding and assessing these risks, and I'm sure has actually better data and better models. The slide on page 2 of the handout, it's actually the third slide. It's actually a FEMA model, annual earthquake losses. And FEMA works in collaboration with insurance industries, banking organizations, to develop these models at a general level for the country. And those insurers, again, have more sophisticated models for different kinds of hazards, including landslides and especially flooding, where they've already captured most of this information. Where they'll be getting supplementary data, and where some of the value of this study comes in, is the inventory and the spatial positioning of each one of these sites. Usually these studies are very generalized, like there's there's an estimate that, well, there's five schools in this county, and they're of such and such a size. What we've done is identify the specific characteristics and the specific enrollment and size of these schools and their location to less than a foot, so in space. So there's actually much more accurate data available now.
Senator George?
With the voter-approved bonds, what's the total amount we have available?
Well, co-chairs and Senator George, do you mean these bonds would be 1/5 to 1% of what is, and I do not know what we have available at this given moment for that. We can certainly get that information for you.
And Senator Morrison.
What about soil type? Now, maybe you've already said this, but it mentions in here the soft landfill soil, the Missoula flood deposited certain in Beaverton area that are more vulnerable. You use that when you evaluate a particular school?
Yes, co-chairs and Senator Morissette. The soil type, the A through F, and it's really B through E, the C, D, and E categories are of the soil types that you're describing. And for example, E soils are the soils that liquefy. They're the ones that sort of just fall apart and behave like a liquid when they shake. So, buildings sink into the ground. The C and D soils, aren't as bad, but they still have specific challenges. I believe the Willamette silt soils are D soil. So yes, and the way it works in the system is that, remember, there's the scoring. You start with a basic number, let's say 3. You start subtracting based on, is the building an E-shaped building? So you take off a number. Is it of a certain age? You take off a number. And is it a soil type? So a D or E soil would have a negative score, which reduces the overall score. So it is incorporated.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. One more question, and then I'm going to have to close the hearing because we have an issue we need to take up. But I want to go ahead, Representative.
Hello. I'll take all 7 of these questions and make them one. Okay? Y'all take notes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I want to know is where to from here. Because it seems like to me, and hearing the news, I just had a bill on the House floor this morning, and that was just after I'd heard the news on several television stations this morning, get ready. Because we had kind of a quiet last year, and now it's time for Katrina again and everything else, because, weather-wise, that was their report. And which, always tells me we're not prepared in this state, and it makes me crazy. So I guess I'm just wondering, how do you turn this data into action? How do you notify the people? What worries me is like seeing a whole school classroom full of kids with meningitis and the doctor saying, yes, there's 43 kids, and some of them weigh 50 pounds, some weigh, 100, but we're not doing anything about it. And I'm worried that we don't have a plan, we don't have a program to get going and do something. And it seems like to me that we need to have an action now plan and, this great utopia someday. We'll be able to afford, the Taj Mahal of everything. But we don't have it right now, but the safety of our people has to be our top priority. So could you just tell me what we can do and use this data meaningfully and get going?
Thank you, co-chairs and Representative Nelson. I think that our recommendation is just what you're saying. We have looked at the scope now. We have the assessment. Let's get the granting committee in place. Let them set the criteria and the eligibility and come back and say and have a discussion on how to get those bonds going so that the state can help the local communities help themselves and address these buildings that they want to do something about. Now, it's not going to happen yesterday. These things, and I have to stress, we have been working at this over time. We're marching forward with this. This is an important step and a plan that has been laid out. But they do take time. It took us some time to get all of this assessment together. I would stress that when you're dealing with the earthquake risk here, it's not quite the same as with Katrina, which is something that is, hurricanes are so frequent. You know you're going to have tornadoes every year. You know you're going to have hurricanes or the potential of that. In here, we know we're going to have landslides every year. We look at the probability of when our earthquakes are going to occur, and it's about a 15% probability in the next 50 years. And it was based on that we said, well, that gives us the time to fix these things right, and that's what we're looking at doing right now. So it is, you know, certainly our recommendation that we move forward with a grant committee.
Senator Johnson,
how closely is that grant committee going to work with the Department of Ed? Because I really think that in some respects you have created issues in that department where they may be, and I don't say this in a pejorative way, but uniquely under-equipped to answer parents' questions about it. Do you have a communication plan? Do you have... I'm looking for integration between Dogami and the Department of Education.
Chairs and Senator Johnson, we have been coordinating with them all along. As a matter of fact, we took the month of April, which was National Earthquake and Tsunami Awareness Month, to craft a series of weekly educational awareness news items that went out to all of the school districts so that they could start thinking about this. We have kept them in the loop all along, and even though Department of Ed, for whatever reason, it was an oversight, I'm sure, when that Senate Bill 3 was drafted, they're not named as being on the committee. They're going to be absolutely crucial to be on the committee and have already said they're quite interested in serving and being a part of that. So we've worked very closely with them.
Well, thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you so
appreciate
much.
Appreciate all your hard work. It's a great document. And I'd like to enter into the record this document that you have in front of you entitled FEMA 154 Rapid Visual Screening of Buildings for Potential Seismic Hazards, submitted by James Bella of Oregon Earthquake Awareness. So, and then with that, is there any other questions or comments? We'll close the informational hearing and close the committee.
Members,
hearing from Senator George.
Thank you. Members, during the course of this committee, we've heard a lot of things that haven't gotten funded that we need to be doing.
You gotta quiet them down.
She just reopened the committee.
Committee's reopened, but he didn't. Thank you. Anyway.
We talked about a number of projects that really needed to get funded that are fundamental to our operations in this committee, and one of those was seafloor mapping. Senator Johnson and I have spent the session sort of talking back and forth about ways that we could get some of those things done, especially when it relates to wave energy and tsunamis and these different things. One of the areas that has seen a huge amount of growth in revenue has been, in other funds, what's called the public purpose charge. This is a fund that was put into the legislature in the statute in late 1990s to fund energy conservation and those kind of projects. It's a 3% charge on your electrical bill. That fund has exploded in growth because of the increase in the amount of revenue coming in because of energy prices going up. That fund is now $135 million per biennium, which is far above what we ever imagined. So we started talking about the concepts and discussing with the chairs about maybe being able to take a one-time removal of that fund to pay for seafloor mapping. And I've spoken to Dogami, and they need about $7.7 million to pay for the seafloor mapping. And I know for those of you who are in the Coastal Caucus, this is very important. After consultation with Senator Johnson and the co-chairs of this committee, I had a priority bill drafted, which I would love to get everybody on board on from our committee. And I've also talked to Senator Brown, who's the chair of rules, which we'll probably go to. And I've also talked with Senator Schrader in case it happens to end up in the Ways and Means, which I'm hoping it does not. What the bill does is two things. Number one, it goes into the public purpose charge and redrafts the public purpose charge so that for a one-time grant of $7.7 million to Dogami to hold until the project is finished for the seafloor mapping through Oregon State University. And that's what DeGamme said that they needed for the committee, for that project. That would fully fund that. We're doing it under the portion of our work here under wave energy, for needing it for wave energy. But obviously the ramifications of the seafloor mapping are huge for a number of the issues that we've discussed here. The second part of it is more of a political portions of it, but since most of us, I'm looking here, represent somewhat rural districts. In talking with the political ability to get this through the building in a rapid time, I enlisted the help of the Oregon Education Association and other school advocates, and we've added another portion of this because as this fund has grown, the opportunity, there's some dollars in there that we could possibly send to schools for energy conservation and other facilities needs. And so this bill has two parts, $7.7 million for the mapping, and then $5 million per year, $10 million per biennium, which will be permanent, which will be grants to those lowest income schools that you saw up here on the board. And that would go for energy conservation and then also facilities conservation to make sure that they're filled. It's written fairly broadly so the schools would have some flexibilities. But that would be a consistent $10 million fixed amount per year, even though the fund keeps increasing, to go to these lower assessed value schools. And I can answer any questions on that. I'm looking for any help I can on this. I'd love to get everybody on the committee on board, and I think we have a really good shot if we stay unified to get this through the process, even though it's at the last minute.
And I just looked that up, public purpose charge, yesterday online at their site at PUC. They're even in discussion of raising it from 3% to 5%. So this, it prescribes a certain percentage to be spent on these different areas, and so there should be quite a bit. Yeah,
well, one of the reasons that this idea intrigued me so much is that we are taking guidance from a number of sources, none the least of which are the executives that were convened by the Oregon Innovation Council to produce a suite of options that are now housed in OECD's budget to look at the development of wave energy. And as the chair of that committee, I believe that we're going to be able to fund the wave research. And it seems to me that in order to help a nascent industry that is coming to this coast looking for opportunity, that if we provide those companies that are coming to Oregon with the tools to understand what the topography and the contours of our ocean floor are, that we'll be able to help guide reasonable and productive investments to site wave energy farms where we're using best science to figure out where are the best waves. And it certainly seems to me that the public purpose fund was designed to help with energy assistance, being on the cutting edge of developing a brand new industry and informing entrepreneurial efforts to come here with publicly owned information about the contours of the seafloor and the potential to develop the right kind of wave energy or the right kind of waves to create the energy strikes me as a very clear opportunity. And I'm not sure it's one that the Energy Trust would have come on its own, so we're giving them a little bit of legislative guidance on where they could make an investment in really a cutting-edge new industry.
Yeah, and just so you also know that in conversations that one of the co-chairs had with the folks over at PUC, there's probably not the authority for the Energy Trust to invest in research and development in energy conservation. So even though their idea, the purpose behind the public purpose charge is to find alternative energies and encourage those, and then also the R&D aspect cannot be done, they believe, under the current statutory authority. This bill grants that outright to do this particular project. And so if we could get everybody on board on this committee, I would really appreciate it.
I need to tell the committee that I spoke with Commissioner Beyer, and that he said that at the present time, obviously that couldn't be done, but it would require a change in statute, but that the legislature could do what it needed to do, and that he certainly would not stand in the way of whatever the legislature decided to do. So
that's a great piece of information.
I worked really hard on this in the last session to be able to access those funds that are helping anybody.
Yeah, Lee.
Nobody would allow it then.
I wanted you all to know that because I think that's important.
But I want to thank you, Senator George, for doing this, because right now, when we looked at this further, as what is how much of the seafloor is mapped presently? It's about 5%. Mm-hmm. And they do about that much a year on a grant if they get it, because it's done. The only charts are made with plumb bobs, basically. I mean, a giant version of a plumb bob.
We're due on the floor. Sorry.
Oh, I know. You've got to go. Thank you very much. I'll close the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you want us to sign